So we continue our deliberations by talking several issues with regards to IFRS 17. I give the floor to Andrea.
Thanks. So, as Hans mentioned, we continue our discussion today on the issues identified, the concerns identified during the implementation of IFRS 17. And the papers for this meeting cover an additional six topics from the list that we presented to you in October, focusing today mainly on scope and transition. We're now a substantial, significant, big way through our deliberations, and we expect that by the end of next month, we'll have discussed all of the issues that we originally raised with you in October. But in terms of next steps, we've got a number of follow-ups, in particular disclosures and the transition impacts of the amendments that you're proposing, and we'll pick up with those afterwards. So our expectation is still that we get an exposure draft out at the end of half one. So with that, I'll pass over to Roberta with a discussion on...
Thank you, Andrea. So this is Agenda Paper 2A that discusses loans that transfer significant insurance risk. These are insurance contracts that typically combine a non-insurance component, being the loan, with an insurance component, being an agreement from the entity to compensate the policyholder by waiving some or all of the payments due under the contract if an insured event adversely affects the policyholder. In the paper, we refer to this contract as insurance contract for which the only insurance in the contract is for the settlement of some or all of the obligation created by the contract. And I wanted just to clarify that the obligation we refer to is the policyholder obligation, not the entity's obligation. This paper does not discuss credit card contracts that might provide additional insurance coverage and for which some stakeholders have expressed concern and implementation challenges similar to those discussed in this paper for loans. So we are still analyzing this example of credit card contract. For the contract discussed in this paper, when applying IFRS 4, some entities currently separate a loan from an insurance contract and account for the loan applying IFRS 9. IFRS 17 does not permit the continuation of this practice, so some stakeholders are concerned that IFRS 17 requires entities to account for those contracts as insurance contracts in their entirety, and that some entities might not have been preparing for that, particularly if those entities do not issue other insurance contracts. The paper considers a number of approaches to address those concerns in the light of the criteria set by the board at the October 2018 meeting. The paper recommends amending IFRS 17 to enable an entity to account for those contracts applying either IFRS 17 or IFRS 9. We think that this would ease IFRS 17 implementation for many entities without unduly impairing comparability. We think that introducing an option would permit entities that would elect to apply IFRS 9 to account for those contracts in the same way as other financial instruments, and to provide useful information about those contracts similarly to entities that would apply IFRS 17 instead. We recommend allowing a choice on a contract-by-contract basis because this would be consistent with the existing scope exclusions in IFRS 17 for financial guarantees contract and for fixed-fee service contract. So I would now hand over to the board for the discussion of this first paper.
Roberta, thanks for the paper and setting out clearly what is obviously an issue for some people, the transition from 4 to 17 and the way that some things are different there in relation to the exclusions that are in paragraph 7 or the components that are in paragraph 10 to 13. So clearly there's an issue here as people go from 4 to 17. So I think the positive aspects of what you're proposing are to do with not interfering with the underlying definition of the insurance contract and also not touching the principles for the separation of the components. So I think you've got a solution that's working around those two things, which is positive. And it also seems to me that considering your comment about some credit card contracts, other than that, it's a reasonably well-defined pool of contracts that this relates to. So they're all the positive aspects of what you're presenting. But, of course, the concern is on the comparability side. I think it does impact comparability because you're now bringing in a choice, and that will be from the user's side, that impact. The preparer's side, presumably they will be choosing to be comparable with the contracts or the entities that they want to be comparable with, and they've got control of that, and that will suit them in terms of the information they're releasing. But the concern, I think, is for the comparability on the other side for what investors are seeing. But that is a concern, but on balance, I will support your recommendation. Thank you.
Sure. I also support the staff recommendation. I think it's important that we address this issue for a couple of reasons. One is because I think that we've talked a lot about disruption, potential disruption from the things that we're looking at in this, these issues that we're following up. And I think that the approach proposed in here has got the least disruption for those applying IFRS 17, because those who looked at IFRS 17 concluded they had insurance risk for these products correctly and are applying 17 in good faith can continue to do that. But I think there's another element of disruption in this which makes it a bit different to everything else we've been talking about, and that's the population of entities who in good faith picked up IFRS 9 and have just finished completing their implementation of that. And they have, in, again, good faith and correctly, accounted for part or all of these contracts in the scope of IFRS 9. And I think to now say, well, I've got news for you, now, well done on completing IFRS 9, now turn around and apply IFRS 17, I think that's a bit of a tough thing to do. Now, if we weren't going to get useful information, if somebody were applying IFRS 9 to these instruments, that would probably make me pause and consider, you know, more carefully whether or not it's appropriate to enable entities who are otherwise applying IFRS 9 to also apply 9 to these products. But I think you can get useful information even applying IFRS 9 for these products. So I don't think there's a loss of information per se from that in that respect. So because of the, I think, the least disruption and the fact that you can have useful information, I'm willing to support this. Obviously, having a choice is never ideal, and there will be effects on comparability for users of financial statements. We will have situations where people could have exactly the same product, some accounting for it under 17, some under 9, and they could get a very different picture, which obviously is not ideal, particularly when 17 is a lot about trying to, you know, make everybody apply similar principles, whether they're insurers or not. But I think given the disadvantages that I just talked about, that in this situation, we can justify that. It does make me wonder whether it should be contract by contract. I have thought about that a lot, or whether it would be better to say for all of the instruments that you have that meet the scope, you know, you have to choose one particular approach, or for subcategories of products that meet these definitions, you have to apply a consistent approach. But I struggle to think about how to define that population in a useful way, because I think we could have situations where somebody might have more than one type of product that's in the scope of what we're looking at here, and they may have good reasons for why they may want to make one choice for one product and one choice for others, and I'm not sure how we would be able to define it in a clear enough way to achieve that. So, again, on balance, I think that this is the best approach given where we are.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I also support staff's proposal, and as Sue mentioned, I suppose that to provide the option for the company to apply either IFRS 17 or IFRS 9. With regard to concern about the comparability issues, as I mentioned, I think it will have these kind of issues. So I would suggest that for those companies, if they're going to using IFRS 17, of course, they should disclose those relevant information according to IFRS 17. If those companies are going to apply IFRS 9, maybe can require them to disclose some additional information because they apply IFRS 9, but maybe IFRS 9 did not provide relevant information about those specific contracts. So in order to improve the transparency and to help the users to identify what kind of contract they they issued and what kind of accounting policy they applied and what's the impact of their financial position and performance. Second, with regarding to the question asked, I think the paper is very clear, but the question we ask is that focus on those insurance contracts for which the only insurance in the contract is for the settlement of some and all of the obligation created by the contract. So we already identified their insurance contract. But we should be aware that in practice, maybe the banks, as example giving the paper, actually they issued a loan contract. So I think maybe in the future, the basis of conclusion, we should illustrate that if the bank issue in the loan contract with those, but which they should, you know, identify whether those loan and chunk contract transfer significant insurance, you know, risk. If not, it's not necessary to go through the whole process to apply whether IFRS 17 or IFRS 9. They simply apply IFRS 9 is okay. If those contracts transfer significant insurance, you know, risk, then they need to apply this requirement to make accounting policy choice. Because here we already help them to make a decision. They are already insurance contract, but in practice, they should make judgment based on those loan contract.
Nick.
Thank you. I'd like to thank staff for the paper, which is very clear in laying out the issues here. I've tried to approach all of these amendments in a pragmatic fashion, but this, I feel, is pushing me to the limit now. It's really testing my levels of tolerance. And here, you know, the raison d'etre of the standard is that we have consistent accounting for all insurance contracts. Indeed, that's what we seek to do throughout all our standards. And here we seem to be ending up with industry-specific accounting solutions. Now, you can argue that works for a banks analyst who's just following banks. It may be very neat for them. They can stay in the world of IFRS 9. If you're an insurance analyst, you can stay in the world of IFRS 17. Very neat. But there are lots of people who follow banks, insurers, and lots of other companies, don't specialize in just one sector. And it's not just the loss of comparability, it's the introduction of complexity. Sitting here, now, this particular product, am I looking at this in 17 or through 9? And above and beyond that, given that the staff proposed that this should be done on a contract-by-contract basis, even if you're within a bank, you could have a situation where both 9 and 17 are being used to account for like contracts, effectively. So I understand that, as Sue said, lots of effort and endeavours have been undertaken in good faith here by many preparers, but I feel this is pushing me right to the limit.
Amaru.
Thanks, Sus. I do agree with staff recommendation. I just, when I heard about comparability, I felt that I could share my view on that. I'm not that concerned, although I understand Nick's arguments. I would expect that mostly banks would continue to apply IFRS 9 for these instruments, while the traditional insurance type entities would apply IFRS 17 because of the nature of the product. It's not very common in all jurisdictions to have insurance companies issuing loans. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm not that concerned with comparability. I would expect users to continue following the traditional portfolio of loans of banks, even with those characteristics, with the same way as they are doing. I would not incentivize us to seek more disclosure, because if you are under IFRS 9, you already have loads of disclosure in IFRS 7, while in 17, we have already a load of disclosure. So I think it's a matter of, if from the point we decide, if we decide to amend and permit the option either 9 or 17, we should leave with 9 or either 17. As long as they adopt. I think the most challenging aspect to me in terms of operation here is the request to do contract by contract. But I do understand the reasons why staff included this.
Mary.
Broadly, I'm supportive of what the staff is raising. I think, I think it's something we should be addressing, you know, this issue that has been raised. And I think, like Anne, I agree, feel strongly that we should not be opening up the broader question of the separation criteria. So, you know, I think the staff has worked well within those constraints. The comments or challenges I have are things that are maybe more at the margins of exactly how we set this relief out. One is the point that several others have mentioned about the election being policy by policy. And I was just trying to see if there's anything that we could look to in IS-8 about accounting policy decisions that would be helpful. And the only thing, I'm sorry I didn't think of doing it before we sat down at the table, is just the point that's made in paragraph 13 of IS-8 that it should apply its policies consistently for similar transactions, other events, and conditions. And I think somewhere there's another discussion about for similar classes of items, because I can see that from a group perspective, if you're a group that has both a kind of traditional banking function and an insurance company, I wouldn't want the relief that we're offering to have to be unwound at the consolidated group level. Mm-hmm. So I can see why we would say, you know, if there's a possibility that both those operations would be issuing these policies, we wouldn't want to impose a requirement for consistency across the group. But I think the idea of the picking and choosing or opening the prospect of picking and choosing at a policy by policy level makes me pretty uncomfortable also. So either we could look at, again, at the language in IFRS 17, which is, you know, thinking about groups or portfolios as the level, or could just look at the general wording in IS-8 in terms of making a consistent policy choice for similar transactions in this case, policies. So that's something I'd like to ask the staff to look at. The other place where I had a question and concern is the equivalent usefulness of the information under IFRS 9. There's a presumption in the paper that if an entity elected to apply IFRS 9, then it would be accounting for these contracts as fair value P&L. And I understand and agree with the idea that commentary in, you know, another standard or another project, you know, about how you interpret and apply IFRS 9 is unhelpful at this point in time and maybe disruptive to the implementation of IFRS 9 itself. But I do, which leads me to say that I think we should be saying if you elect to apply IFRS 9, that the items should be measured at fair value P&L. And the reason for this is that one of the anchors for me of IFRS 17 is current estimate of cash flows discounted at a current rate. And to me, the only assurance I'd have that I get that in IFRS 9 is a fair value measurement. And so I think that drives me to saying a condition of making that election is fair value P&L. Now, the difference between fair value P&L and amortized cost might not be big, or the loss of information might not be significant if there's not significant insurance risk. But if that's the case, then this isn't, you know, then that contract is not part of this debate because there isn't significant insurance risk. And if there is significant insurance risk, I would want to be pushing for that current measurement of the, you know, of the item that we've moved to IFRS 9. So it's the policy by policy, and the ensuring that we get comparably useful information if something is accounted for under IFRS 9 by getting current value measurement. That are the two aspects of this proposal that I have questions about.
Daryl.
So a couple of comments. I think to start out with, I agree with the staff recommendation. I agree with the direction it's taking. I do think that there is some merit in thinking about whether a portfolio approach, say, would work For reasons I think others have touched on, I don't agree with a full entity approach, because I think the problem is exactly this group thing where you've got sort of your bank group and your insurance group accounting in their own way, and then when you come to consolidate them, you have to unwind some of that. I think it's important to bear in mind that I think, Mary, to your comment on the ISA test, I think in some circumstances there could be a very similar product being sold in the bank and the insurance company. And because because of the reason why we want to give this relief, I think if we were to try and apply an ISA-type test, I think it would actually override that. but I do wonder if we could think about portfolio, and I think that's perhaps something to put out there. That said, I think we've applied other exceptions in IFRS 17, and I can think of at least two off the top of my head, where we've used a contract-by-contract basis. And I think there's a bit of an assumption here that people will do the sensible thing. I agree with Amaro, I think, on the additional disclosures issue if we are pushing stuff to IFRS 9. My view would be that IFRS 9 has been written with complex financial instruments in mind. It is specifically designed and developed the idea of complexity in terms of the disclosures that are required. And so I would think that once you are in IFRS 9, IFRS 9 is capable of handling disclosures of complex features in contracts. And we should remember here we're talking about insurance, but a lot of contracts have complicated interest components and other things that make them difficult, and IFRS 9 deals with that. And I think that would probably lead me to the other point that you made, Mary, which is I think from my perspective, we have a robust SPPI test in IFRS 9. That robust test is intended to capture contracts that have significant variations in value as a consequence of something other than PPI. The definition in SPPI and the definition in insurance of what is significant are different definitions. And so I think you come to different conclusions. But sort of coming back a little bit to Nick's point, my concern would be that we have, in creating the uncertainty that Nick was worried about, what we've now got is we've got IFRS 9 as applied by everybody except to this one product, then IFRS 9 as applied to this one product, and then IFRS 17. And so we're creating actually, I think, additional complexity if we were to do that. So to be honest, I think I would be comfortable with the staff recommendation as written.
So
I have to respond because somebody talked about IFRS 9. I agree with Daryl's comments, which is I think that we built IFRS 9 in a way which was designed to deal with classifying whatever type of financial instrument got thrown at it. So I think we should be confident that IFRS 9's principles for what solely payment of principal and interest can cope with these instruments. I might have my personal views on where I think you should land, but I think we need to be careful because what the idea of significance is in 17 and what we focus on in 9 is slightly different. Also, scope slightly different. So 17 considers contracts plus legal and statute, etc., and 9 specifically focuses on contract. So I think we might be going down a slippery slope, and also it's meant to be principles-based in 9, so I'd rather we relied on that.
Martin.
Yeah, I also agree with staff recommendation and answers. What Mary said, okay, we should require then fair value in 9, I don't think we don't need that because SPPI test is quite clear in these circumstances for me, and I think we have a lot of guidance what kind of features are allowed to have this SPPI consideration, and I don't think we should in this kind of regards and making some kind of, if we expecting, okay, that small insurance components would meet then the SPPI test or not, I think it is clear for me, but therefore I think I would not recommend that. And also the kind of disclosure, I think it would be a little bit odd if we as you said, 9 deals with very complex financial instruments where we have a lot of disclosure, and if there is a small insurance component included, then we asking specific disclosure. So I would not, and we have to open 9, I think, for that. We cannot do that in 17 to require disclosure about instruments which are accounted under 9, and I think it is not worth it, and cost benefit would not make it worth to add disclosure requirements for this in 9.
Okay, can I? Yeah, yes.
Okay, so on the disclosure point, I think I'm hearing that most of the room is not sympathetic to adding additional disclosures. But if I could suggest, I mentioned at the beginning that we would be looking at the impact of all the amendments on disclosures. So we'll consider this as part of that. And if there's anything that we think is missing, we'll bring it as part of that paper. So I think we can deal with the disclosure point. I'm hearing as well that there isn't much appetite to restrict to fair value P&L when applying 9 from most of the people in the room as well. But there is a, while I think all of you said that you're happy to support the staff recommendation, I am picking up that there's a bit of a disquiet over contract by contract versus portfolio by portfolio. And some of you did raise that with some of the staff before the meeting. We've thought about it, and although we've recommended contract by contract because it's consistent with the other scope exceptions in IFRS 17, we think that they wouldn't be much disadvantage to going to portfolio by portfolio if that makes you more comfortable with the recommendation. The disadvantage of portfolio by portfolio is that we would be meaning portfolio as defined in IFRS 17, which is a specific definition. However, if you're a bank who wants to apply IFRS 9 to all your contracts, then that's not relevant. If you're a bank that wants to apply IFRS, or a group that wants to apply IFRS 9 to some contracts and IFRS 17 to other contracts, you're going to need to know what portfolio is anyway. So we think there's a limited disadvantage to going to portfolio by portfolio. So if you wanted, we could try to take an indication of whether that would be a more acceptable recommendation.
And a portfolio, if I may, is defined as a comprised contract subject to similar risk and managed together. So it's kind of aligning with the way that entities manage their portfolios or the assets anyway. So
and
it's quite consistent.
Would you be proposing an election portfolio by portfolio or an accounting policy choice portfolio portfolio? Because I think they mean slightly different things when you get to IS8.
I think
an election.
It would be an election. The disadvantage of going with a policy choice on IS8 is, I think, when you get to the consolidated level, as Beryl mentioned, you would have to unwind the relief in the consolidated financial statements, and we want to avoid that, so that's why it would be an election.
Do we support the staff's recommendation, including the inclination towards a portfolio approach?
13.1. So moving on to transition papers. We have three transition papers. We'll start with paper 2B. 2B is talking about optionality and comparative information. It presents staff analysis and recommendation on two topics, optionality in transition approaches and comparative information on transition to IFRS 17. So we're going to introduce each topic separately. You can discuss separately and vote separately for each. First one is optionality. Some stakeholders are concerned that optionality and availability of different transition approaches could reduce comparability of entities' performance after the date of transition, potentially for a number of years. In particular, the opening balance of the CSM could have a significant impact on profitability going forward. The concerns expressed by stakeholders are similar to the concerns that the board heard and considered during the development of the transition requirements in IFRS 17. The staff do not think that amending the transition requirements of IFRS 17 to limit the availability of any approach or choices available to an entity on transition would meet the criteria for amending IFRS 17 set by the board, and as it may unduly disrupt implementation already underway. The staff recommended the board retain the IFRS 17 transition requirements without amendment that would reduce the optionality included in those requirements. So I hand over to you for discussion.
Nick.
Thank you. So I understand the concerns of the stakeholders referred to, which I assume are mainly users in this respect, who clearly have a great deal of frustration over the accounting for insurance contracts as they've dealt with for many years. However, while the approach taken in the standard and with the disclosure optionality isn't ideal, for me, it's a price worth paying, I would say, you know, to get to that place where we can have fulfill the objective of having meaningful and truly international consistent accounting for insurance contracts. So I understand exactly frustrations and people's concerns, but I think there is no other option if we want to get to the end goal. So I support the staff recommendation.
There's no other option but accepting the options.
Indeed. Thank you.
Okay. Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
All right. Comparative information. Some stakeholders expressed a view that there is insufficient time to implement IFRS 17 before 1st of January 2021, so it is in the past, and suggest that the board could address these concerns by permitting entities not to present adjusted comparative information when applying IFRS 17. IFRS 9 has different approach to restating comparative information than IFRS 17, and some stakeholders are concerned that financial statements that restate comparative information about insurance contracts but not about financial assets could distort users' understanding of those entities' economic circumstances and transaction in prior periods and current period as well. The staff note that the board has already tentatively decided to defer the effective date of IFRS 17 by 1 year, and this gives entities further year to prepare comparative information. When developing the requirements of IFRS 17, the board considered the disadvantages that would result if entities restate comparative information for insurance contract, but not for financial assets. However, the board concluded that an entity can avoid accounting mismatches because it is permitted but not required to restate comparative information applying IFRS 9 if it is possible without the use of hindsight. The staff think that these considerations made by the board are still valid. Therefore, the staff recommend that the board retain the IFRS 17 requirements to present restated comparative information for the annual reporting period immediately preceding the date of initial application of IFRS 17. I hand over to you for discussion.
I suppose this decision is as easy as the previous one. Sue?
No, I do agree with the staff recommendation, but should talk about it a bit because it's important to people. I think that the fact that we are proposing moving the effective date out hopefully provides some assistance for one of the concerns that has been raised about comparatives, which is the amount of real lead time they had relative to what they may have had in other circumstances. So I think hopefully that is helpful. Also, I continue to believe that for the same reasons that we originally decided we needed comparatives, which this is just such a fundamental change in accounting for insurance companies, that it's particularly important for investors to have all the assistance they can get with trend information to help them understand what's a change in accounting versus a change in economics as we move to the new accounting model. And also, I think for me, since we first published it, I've gotten some additional data points, at least anecdotal ones, which is that I'm yet to meet an investor who thanks me for the lack of comparative information on IFRS 15 and IFRS 9. So yeah. I think that personally I'm more cautious about providing relief from comparatives than I even was when I voted on IFRS 17. So for those reasons, I agree with where the staff's landed.
Errol.
So I agree with just about everything Sue said. I'd probably add on to that. The thing that makes IFRS 17 unique in a lot of ways is that people aren't starting from a common starting point. So you can't extrapolate or imagine where people, what the effect is of the prior year if it isn't actually restated. And I think it simply means that it will mean that you end up providing your first year results without any context whatsoever. I think what comparatives do is they provide that context. I'd also say that I think there's a select group of people who are looking at this and possibly looking at this as an alternative to an extension of the date. Most of the insurers I've spoken to have been pretty sure that they want to present comparatives because they need to contextualize the numbers themselves when they talk about them.
Martin.
In the same direction, I also agree with staff recommendation because I think it is different to 9. Nine, we had some also changes, but they were not so fundamental coming from 39 to 9 as we have here, coming from different bases and then coming to IFRS 17. And we have heard also through implementation and TRG, it is a complex standard and difficult to understand. And I think it is, especially for users, I think, in this year of transition to understand what is maybe an economic development in the business and what is accounting driven is so important in this standard. And therefore, I also understand people who say, okay, there is maybe an, I wouldn't say mismatch, but okay, why is 9 then different to 17, and then if we do both in the same year, I think we have in the comparative year, we don't show the best result of our asset liability management because we were not able to restate maybe 9 already, and therefore we have an issue. Yes, I agree, but I think what is the most important issue for me is, okay, that users understand, especially for 17, what is economic benefits and what is really accounting-driven things, and therefore I think we, as we have done in the development of the standard, I think it is important that we need comparative information, and with now with this one-year deferral, we have also heard arguments, okay, that people need more time, but we have already deferred for 1 year, so I'm still fine with our decisions that we asking for comparatives.
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
All right.
Moving on to the next paper on transition, paper 2C, risk mitigation option and amounts accumulated in OCI. So this paper includes two topics. The first one is prohibition of retrospective application of the risk mitigation option. And the second one is the termination of the cumulative amount of insurance finance income or expense recognized in OCI on transition. So we're going to do it the same way. We're going to introduce each topic separately, and you can discuss this separately. First one, prohibition of retrospective application of the risk mitigation option. Some stakeholders continue to be concerned that the risk mitigation exception in IFRS 17 can only be used prospectively, even though risk mitigation activities may have been in place before the date of initial application of IFRS 17, meaning 1st of January 2022. Given that the CSM on transition will be allocated to profit or loss in future periods, those stakeholders are concerned that the CSM on transition that does not reflect risk mitigation activities from previous periods may distort the equity and the revenue. And the way it's going to look is that the equity of entities on transition is going to be distorted because the effect of previous changes in the fair value of the derivatives will be included in equity on transition, while the corresponding effect on the reinsurance contract will be included in the CSM on transition. And for the revenue recognized for these groups of contracts in future period will be impacted because the CSM on transition includes the changes in financial risk that would have been excluded had the risk mitigation option been applied retrospectively. The staff understand that this effect can be significant, and the effect on profitability going forward could last for a long time. Some stakeholders suggested the board should amend the transition requirements of IFRS 17 in one of the following ways. So first option is to allow entities to apply the risk mitigation option fully retrospectively or prospectively from the transition date rather than the date of initial application. Second proposal is to allow entities to apply the risk mitigation option retrospectively, provided that they can demonstrate that they had a previously documented risk management objective and strategy for using derivatives to mitigate financial risk arising from insurance contract. And the third approach is similar to the second approach, except that the entity would be required to apply the risk mitigation option for all circumstances that a previously documented risk management objective and strategy exists. So this is an all or nothing approach. While a retrospective application that would not use hindsight may also provide useful information to users of financial statements about risk mitigation activities that actually took place in previous periods, it is hard for the staff to see how the option could be applied retrospectively without the use of hindsight and without risking cherry picking. The staff observed that any approach that allows retrospective application may have this problem, but possibly to a different degree. The staff is continuing to explore whether there could be other ways other than retrospective application to address stakeholders' concerns, and will bring a paper to a future meeting. In the meantime, we recommend that the board should retain the requirements in IFRS 17 relating to the prohibition of retrospective application of risk mitigation option on transition to IFRS 17. And with that, I open it for the board to discuss.
Well,
I'm really sympathetic to the constituents that ask to have the possibility of, in fact, accounting faithfully for the hedging strategies that they've put in place and adequately documented. So I'm ready to wait for the next paper to see whether you have a better solution, because I would agree that trying to minimize the risk of insight and trying to minimize the risk of gaming are good objectives. But I would rather have run the risk of having some of it rather than deciding against the better accounting for those who want to report their activities faithfully. So in the meanwhile, I'm not supporting the staff recommendation.
Mary?
I support the staff recommendation that we not allow retrospective application for the reasons the staff has set out. I did, however, when thinking about the issues summarized in the paper and the different alternatives that have been suggested to us, let me characterize it as having some sympathy under reasonably tight conditions for allowing application from the transition date rather than from the date of adoption. So from the beginning of the comparative period that is restated. And the additional condition that I would expect is not only the one of there being a documented hedge strategy, but the election having been made and documented before getting to the actual date of transition. So it isn't just that you have to have the documentation of the risk management in place, but that you have to have decided what you're going to elect or what you're not. And it's the same going in blind, and that will eliminate both hindsight and cherry picking on a prospective basis. I recognize that would not address all of the concerns about the potential for cumulative impact on the CSM, but presumably the extra year, at least some have seen it as helpful because it was one of the suggestions put forward. And while I'm not supportive of it just on the basis of having a documented risk management strategy, I think you have to guard against the abuse concern. I think it would be possible to build it in. So I would rather that we explored whether, the cost benefit that would come with the complexity of permitting this to be done under certain conditions at the transition date.
Daryl.
I would agree with Mary's comments on this one. I think it might be useful to explore, and I don't know if we've really fully explored it in this paper, but the idea of looking at prospectively from the transition date. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually possibly supports a little bit of the discussion that we had a few minutes ago in terms of thinking about how important comparators are, because I think that would mean that the comparators would be on the same basis. So I think it is definitely worth exploring. I think to pick up further on that, though, I suspect that we may need to think about how we would guard against the same risk of cherry-picking that we worried about in other circumstances. And so we just need to think a little bit about how we would cover for that.
Sorry, but how much of the problem could that solve?
I think it covers one element of the problem, which is comparative reporting. I'm not sure it's a significant, because it doesn't roll up the past experience.
Yeah, that's why I think it would be rather
it's limited
marginal.
Benefit, and I'd say
comparatives to the point that we were discussing before, that if you did it only prospective from the date of initial application, the comparative doesn't reflect the risk mitigation activities at all. At least both the comparative, the flows would reflect the same thing, even if the opening balance was not reflecting.
But still, your CSM on transition would include the financial risk that would not have been included have you had a chance to apply retrospective application. So it does not solve all the problem. It adds more comparability, I guess, or more information on the reporting period and comparative period, but it does not address the full problem.
Clear, but yes. I mean, is it 5% or is it 80%?
It's not 80%, I don't think.
That's what I figured, so I don't know how much.
A
That's why I said think about cost benefit and the complexity that it would add. But the fact that some stakeholders suggested it implies to me that some think it's worthwhile.
So that said, then in thinking about the other ones, your options which are set out in paragraph 11, I'd sort of exclude that, put it aside, because I think that's a slightly different issue. I think the rest of what's expressed in A, B, and C is essentially dealing with the cumulative bit, how you actually handle that cumulative bit. I have some sympathy because I can understand how if you could reflect this information going back, it would make the information more economically representative. But I have a real concern with the cherry picking. I think that we've got sufficient, if we're talking about fully retrospective here, we've got sufficient requirements in the standard that if you were to go back, you would have to apply properly as though you had gone back. But I think for many insurance companies, they do have the information available to do that part of it. They've probably got some sort of risk information that they can point to that is point in time for when they originated the contract. They've probably done some internal tracking of the information. And if they haven't, they're not fully retrospective, so I don't think they would be compliant. So I have some sympathy. I think we can get past that concern on hindsight. But the real concern for me with hindsight is the cherry picking. And I understand where Francois is coming from in saying, look, don't focus too much on what people might do with ill-considered approaches. But the problem is what you end up doing is you end up tainting the whole pool. So from a user perspective, do you ever know who may or may not have, who may have done it right and who may not have? So you just end up not trusting that number at all because there is the sort of tainting that can occur with it. I've spent some time we had quite a lot of telephone calls and correspondence over the last 10 days and spent some time talking to insurers. And for a while, I was quite drawn to the approach in C, what you described, I think, as the all or nothing approach. So essentially saying what you do is you must just capture every single thing that is within your risk management universe and roll that forward. The hassle is that the more we've talked to insurers, the harder it is to actually establish that they have any way of verifying what was in that universe at a point in time somewhere in the past. And I think that means that you just get back very quickly to the cherry picking. If you can't verify it, then what you end up saying is your risk management starting point is the information that you provide at that point in time. And that's back to cherry picking. I provide the information about the relationships I want to. So because I'm concerned about the verification issue, I think we are probably back in saying that the best way to ensure a common starting point for everybody that provides information that is understandable in terms of what it means is probably the no look back, so non-retrospective. I'll probably stop there. And so I think that's probably where I'm left. I accept this is not the perfect answer.
But for the users, it would be impossible to establish the comparability of the distortion in the CSM.
That's the problem.
Equity.
I also think, and I think sometimes we talk about it as though insurers will deliberately go out. Even I've sometimes talked about it and said, well, maybe some insurer will go out and deliberately target the CSM they want. But I think even if they don't do that, if they just pick their easiest relationships to account for, that's going to present a distorted picture. If they look at what's happened over the last 4 years or 5 years and just pick the ones that turned out to be effective, that distorts the relationship. So whichever way you play it, you end up with distortions, even without a deliberate intent.
There will be distortion.
Yeah.
There will be distortion, and the user will not be able to see how much distortion.
Yeah.
So there's also lack of comparability.
Well, the entity can certainly provide information that the user can use as a starting point for discussion.
Yeah. I guess what Daryl's saying, in a way, is that however you do it, there will be distortion. If everyone's doing the same thing, then there's this
starting
point. If everyone's doing different ways, which is also distorted, you have to work out, first
sure
of all, that's...
If there is a common starting point, because there will be companies that have heavily used derivatives in the past, and there will be that haven't, and they will have completely different pictures, but I don't think that is...
Yeah, but what you will know...
for the user.
But what you will know is that the number from before has got no reflection of the risk mitigation activities from before, whereas if we allow some retrospective, you'll know that some have got 3 years, 1 year, 2 year, partial, 30%, 20%. You won't know. There's a much greater range of possibilities of where they started from. So I think it's not ideal, but I can see why it might be simpler just to say there is no reflection and we're going to start from here, rather than we're going to let everyone choose a different starting point and you need to unwind also the distortion plus which starting point they chose.
Martin?
Yeah, man. I also see it is a big issue for companies who have done risk mitigation in the past and have done it in good faith and now not allowed, okay, to using that for the opening CSM. I totally, and that was also the reason why I, when we discussed it in December, asked maybe we can discuss it again because it is a big issue for some companies. But also thinking about, okay, what does mean fully retrospective in this? And what Daryl said, man, you can use cherry picking in each and every year in each and every portfolio and not only for this stuff where maybe there is an issue. And therefore, on balance, I think there is not any perfect solution for that. So I think if we would allow that, then we're allowing entities who have not done that to cherry pick, okay, in which year they start and based on is it a debit or credit in the CSM where they're doing that. And therefore, also, I think this information coming out of that is not good. So I think she is currently, and I don't see any perfect solution if we allow or don't allow. And therefore, on balance, I think I would say we should not allow fully retrospective. At least what we should do is, okay, we should allow what Mary suggested, okay, from the starting period of the comparative period, because what I said when we discussed the comparative period, I think it is we have to distinguish between accounting and economic. So I have to say we at least we should do it from the starting period of the comparative, because otherwise you have this impact, especially in these 2 years, in the middle of these 2 years, where you have then allowing hedge accounting or risk mitigation, where you the year before you have not allowed that. So at least we have to do that. But I'm happy that staff said, okay, today we want to look any more detail into this issue and maybe come up with an alternative solution. So still looking for that, but on this paper, I agree, okay, we should not allow fully retrospective because it's cherry picking. What then on the other side is taught all the meaningful economic information.
And comment on the. So if we just allow this option to the point of data transition 1 year earlier, then you think there's no risk of cherry picking?
As Mary said, okay, we should do that then, okay, that we should require that on first gen of the comparative period, they should have documentation in place for risk mitigation. Maybe we asking it should be audited or same as it would be usually when we, so it should be not, this documentation should not available on initial recognition, on initial, what is it?
Adoption.
So what we will be looking at is not to allow a retrospective application for 1 year, but a prospective application starting earlier, which means that we need to find a way, and we really think really hard, if there's a way to document and to flag that we made those decisions at that time and then take them forward without knowing how the future has been developed. So it's different than retrospective. To 1 year, it's just prospective. And what this paper is about and what we've explored at the moment is whether we can do something to solve this problem, because we recognize it is a problem using any retrospective combination. And we concluded that it's difficult. So what we are planning to do in the future is looking whether there is another solution that does not look at retrospective application, but maybe a prospective or maybe another solution that will solve this situation.
So what you just described, that using different approach rather than retrospective approach, you are saying prospective approach from the date of transition.
Oh, from transition.
So you are saying that in that case, there's no problem, no hindsight bias, right?
Try to lock down the option to have any cherry picking. Yeah,
we will analyze whether that is possible and bring that to a future meeting. I think that's our plan.
Yes, this is what we want.
And at the same time, we will also continue to explore whether there is any approach for the other bigger problem. So there's two legs to that we will bring back to a future meeting.
Sue?
I think this is a really difficult issue because for the same reasons why it's really important
to people that they be allowed to have retrospective application because of the very significant effect it can have on the financial statements for many, many years. That's why we're so nervous about it, because of the sort of cherry-picking risk. And I think it's helpful for people, even if the board supports the staff recommendation and doesn't support retrospective application, having a good articulation of what our concerns were so that people can respond and tell us either that we're missing the point or that there's ways to deal with our concerns and we're in a better place for re-deliberations. And I think we have to be a little bit careful with this argument of that it's not a faithful representation. I think that's an easy argument to make, and I understand, I'm not being dismissive, but I understand the point that if you can only see one part of the relationship and not the other, then it's an incomplete picture. So I can understand why people would say that's not a faithful representation. But if people can just choose particular relationships to choose a particular effect, I'm not sure that's necessarily a faithful representation either. It's a faithful representation of the picture they chose to present, but it's not a neutral depiction. So I think we need to be a little bit careful with that argument. Also, I think we need to think carefully about how much we're really taking away from people. Because to apply this properly, retrospectively, without hindsight, is quite a big thing to do. Mm-hmm. You can't just pick up your hedging derivatives and say that the effect on the fulfillment cash flows would be the equal and opposite. You're required to directly measure the effect on your fulfillment cash flows of this risk mitigation strategy that you had. And doing that without hindsight for history...
For each period of time.
...is, I think, a non-trivial exercise. So it might sound cruel, but would the outcome really be that different if you sat down and did it scientifically? I'm not sure. Maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't feel like an easy thing to do. And I think the reason why I'm particularly worried about cherry-picking here is because it's not even like you're choosing, you know, particular contracts. You're choosing particular risks within contracts. So it's a very granular potential level of cherry-picking that you can choose. And I think that for me to get comfortable with this, I think to be convinced, you know, I support the staff recommendation, but one of the reasons why I do is because I could only, I think, ever accept this if it was an all-or-nothing approach. And I just can't get my head around how we can be confident we've got an all-or-nothing approach where there was no historical requirement to document these things in a particular way. It's not like there's hedge accounting documentation requirements. People may well have good documentation because they're, you know, thorough risk managers and that was their processes. But is that going to be true everywhere? And are we going to have a situation where auditors can truly verify completeness? And so this completeness and what it really means in the absence of a historical requirement to have a particular type of documentation would be something that when people write us letters, if they don't, you know, with whatever we've got in the ED, I'd be very, very interested to understand better how they think we could possibly get comfortable if we're trying to focus on completeness.
Errol?
And I think that covered just about everything I was thinking of saying.
Mary?
Just trying to process Sue's remarks. I still want the staff to think about prospective application from the transition date. But and as I said, with the additional factor of prospective application, including documentation by the transition date of what election you are making under IFRS 17 for risk mitigation, because of course that's an election that you make rather than it rolls forward. And I think the other thing that you have to think about as you're assessing this potential alternative is whether we would require or permit that to be applied prospectively from the transition date. Because, of course, if you don't elect it by that date, you know, if it's required and you don't elect it by that date, you can't then elect it at the date of adoption, I don't think. You know, just... Think about whether we'd have to make it a further option or if the way the option in 17 is written, you could elect it at that later point. I don't think you can.
Okay.
So we vote, noting that the staff is doing further work.
Yep.
Yeah. So we'll probably... this will be brought back. Given all that, who supports the staff recommendation?
Question one.
Question one.
13.
All right. Good. So second topic of this paper is the determination of the cumulative amount of insurance finance income or expense recognizing other comprehensive income on transition. This topic is only relevant if entities choose to apply the OCI option in IFRS 17. So some stakeholders raise concerns that the outcome of applying the transition requirements of IFRS 17 will result in determining the accumulated amount in OCI for insurance contract as nil, while the amount accumulated in OCI for the related assets would not be nil. They think that this effect could significantly distort the components of equity on transition to IFRS 17 and affect the investment margin reported in profit or loss in future periods. Some stakeholders have suggested the board should amend the requirements of IFRS 17 to either permit an entity to deem the accumulated amount in OCI related to the assets as nil, or to permit an entity to deem the amount accumulated in OCI for the insurance liability as equal to the amount that is there for the related assets. Given that these are not VFA contracts where an entity holds the underlying items and therefore the assets may not be clearly identified with the insurance contracts, some stakeholders suggest that the related assets should be identified consistently with an entity's ALM assets liability management practices or using a pro rata allocation. The staff think that these suggested approaches may reduce the usefulness of information provided because of the potential subjectivity involved in determining which assets relate to which insurance contract. It can also reduce comparability between entities issuing similar contracts but just holding different assets, as the information provided will be affected by the assets that are held. Also important to note that a full retrospective approach for the insurance contract, if it was practicable to apply, would not necessarily result in the same amount of OCI in both parts of the balance sheet. Considering that applying OCI in IFRS 17 is a choice, and the disclosure requirements set by the board in response to similar feedback you have received in the past, we recommend that the board should not amend IFRS 17 with respect to the cumulative amount included in OCI. I hand it over to you for discussion.
Darryl. I think this is pretty much the same issue as the one we've just discussed, except it's likely to be supported by even less documentation, and there's even likely to be even less ability to justify completeness. So for me, these two are exactly the same, and I think we need to consistently reflect decisions for both of them.
I agree with Darryl that the issue is similar, but I think that in this case, you really don't have any sound basis of any kind.
Sorry?
So you don't have any sound basis. If there were other proposals on the table to accommodate the issue, I would also be sympathetic to them. But here we don't have anything that provides a sound basis for.
Sorry, something to react to what Daryl just said. I think there is a bit of difference between this and the first issue, because if they would have applied OCI fully retrospectively, like the risk mitigation, they might not get the amount of OCI equal on the assets and the liability. What they are asking here is fair or not fair, but it's a fresh starting point. But you never know if this is what you would have gotten if you apply retrospectively. Whereas with the risk mitigation, you might get very close to what you would have gotten.
Do we support the staff's recommendation?
14. Good, thank you.
Okay, so we'll move on to 2D. So agenda paper 2D is our last transition paper here, and that's on applying the modified retrospective approach. The paper is split up into two parts. The first part is on the requirements to use reasonable and supportable information and stakeholder concerns about interpreting what reasonable and supportable information is and how they prove it. In the analysis, the staff provide explanation on how the requirements apply and why we think a change to the requirements is not necessary. And therefore, the staff recommend that the board retain the requirements in IFRS 17 relating to reasonable and supportable information. The second part of the paper is on the specified modifications that are included in the modified retrospective approach, and the stakeholder concerns that they think the approach is just too restrictive. One of the stakeholder suggestions in the paper is for the board to permit entities to develop their own modifications when applying the modified retrospective approach. The staff think that doing this could risk an entity moving so far away from retrospective application that it is no longer able to meet the objective of the modified retrospective approach. And therefore, the staff recommend that the board does not amend IFRS 17 to permit this. One of the specific stakeholder concerns in the paper relates to contracts that were acquired in their settlement period before the transition date, and the classification of liabilities for those as either a liability for remaining coverage or as a liability for incurred claims. For that topic, the staff recommend that the board add a specified modification. And like all of the existing modifications that we have, this one would apply only to the extent that the entity doesn't have reasonable and supportable information to apply a retrospective approach. The paper notes that the same concern applies also in the fair value approach, and so the staff also recommend a related amendment to the fair value approach. Just a couple of things I wanted to highlight. The first is that some stakeholders have told us that they think that the modified retrospective approach is as restrictive or even more restrictive than a full retrospective approach. And they've said that because they think that the existence of specified modifications prohibits them from using their normal estimation techniques. Mm. And in paragraph 36 of the paper, we clarify that this isn't the case. And just the second thing is just a reminder that this paper doesn't discuss stakeholders' concerns about applying the level of aggregation requirements in IFRS 17 on transition, because we have a level of aggregation paper coming to a future board meeting. So with that, I'd now like to pass over to the board to discuss this paper.
About the complexity of existing practice and the difficulties of transitioning from entities where their reporting is not comparable. So that does put a lot of pressure on the transition requirements. But as I evaluated what you presented in the paper, I couldn't see how allowing more modifications in would help with the problem of providing information that the users would be able to use and information that's informative about the status of entities. So I wasn't supportive of putting in and allowing further modifications other than the one that is specifically proposed, but generally increasing modifications and allowing choice, more choice around how the transition is done. I wasn't supportive of that because I just think it complicates something that is already complicated and doesn't meet the objectives that we're trying to do here with the transition requirements. So I'm supportive of what's being proposed in the paper in terms of restricting how many changes we make.
Thank you. I strongly support that we are going to incorporate some of the wording written in paragraph 36. Because this would clarify that they can estimate in order to make specified modifications. Because some people have pointed out specified modification is so restrictive. So therefore, if you look at the diagram of page 20, first you have a choice whether or not you go to modified retrospective or a fair value approach, it's a choice. Then if you go to modified retrospective approach, you have to go through whether or not you have enough evidence to support the modified retrospective approach. But if you miss some part of the information, then you cannot apply modified retrospective approach. In the end, you have to go back to fair value approach. So it looks like we are incentivizing to go to fair value approach, but that is not our intention. Our intention is basically the full retrospective approach is the best. And if you do not have enough information, full retrospective approach, then you should use modified retrospective approach. So we rather prefer to make a modified retrospective approach, which is as close as to the full retrospective approach. So therefore, now constituents get it wrong because IFRS may have intention to put them into the full fair value approach rather than fair value approach rather than modified. That is not our intention. So therefore, in order to make it clear, to put the literature written in paragraph 36 clearly in the standard, not BC basis, is important. So I fully support the recommendation.
Mary?
I share some of Tuck's support for clarification of this point on not just the permission but the requirement to use estimation, in the process. I think that's it's important to be clear about that, and it's important that people are approaching it the same way. I think, though, it also, as we're reporting on the things we're not doing, it is important for us to articulate. It's not because we're being mean or just, trying to limit the amount of change, that the objective for us designing a limited number of specified reliefs was for us to manage globally the comparability of the transition from many different starting points. And, if I look way back, that's a lot of what IFRS 1 was trying to do. And people moving to IFRS standards from many different starting points, the board felt it necessary to identify what they thought were going to be the biggest barriers to change and prescribe how people approach those, sometimes electively, sometimes mandatorily, so that there would be at least a rough approximation of consistency in the transition. And I think we have to remind people that it's not just being parsimonious on our part or not understanding the challenges, but it's to not only get to IFRS 17, and Nick talked before about some of the necessary compromises to get to what is the ultimate objective, but also to give some reasonable discipline in the process of getting there so that the opening balance has some meaning. So I think we have to emphasize that as much as because you haven't made the case kind of thing.
Meryl?
So picking up on what Mary just said, so I think transition for this project is hard. We're asking people to do a very big step to move off lots of very different approaches that they've applied for a number of years. Everybody knows what fully retrospective transition is. That's a very easy thing to understand. I think everybody pretty much knows at least how to think about fair value, so that's an easy concept or principle to understand. As soon as we get into modified retrospective, what we're essentially doing is we're writing a bunch of rules. And I think if there's going to be value in that process, they need to be going, because it's going to be hard work whichever way they do it. If there's going to be value in that process, they need to be getting to a number that people, in users, investors, can look at and say, yes, okay, I can understand this is a robust number, I can understand the work that went into it. And I think it's to people's benefit, if you're going to go through that, to know that you've been able, you and your compatriots have been able to apply a robust approach. So in terms of allowing modifications without placing a restriction on what those modifications are, I think that detracts from the value of the number. I think there is nothing for people to aim for. So it's kind of just whatever seems to go if you apply that type of approach. So that would just reduce the value of that number until it becomes meaningless, I think. In terms of not using reasonable and supportable information, I think that does the same, because again, you detract them from the robustness of what you're producing. So what's the effort about? Why should you? And if you've done the work and somebody else hasn't, who can tell? So I think that's the second one that's really important. I think it's useful that people have sent us some specific thoughts they have for modifications we can consider, and I think the analysis that the staff have gone through is good on those. I agree also with the one that we've said yes to. I think that's a positive in the process. So overall, I agree, and I think this is to the benefit of the people applying the process as much as it is to the investors in the industry.
Sue?
I agree with the staff recommendations, including the recommendation for the introduction of another specific modification. And I think it's really important that we emphasise, I find it unusual that people would think we'd be happy with anything other than a reasonable and supportable basis to do things, which would imply an unreasonable and unsupportable basis is okay. I think this is just, for me, in a sense, just sensible discipline for a process where you have estimation. The thing that does strike me, though, both in talking to the staff and preparing for this discussion, but also talking to people outside the building in terms of the level of concern there's been sometimes in conversations around the modified retrospective approach, I think there's a real lack of understanding in terms of how to read the modified retrospective paragraph when we talk about reasonable and supportable, when we talk about undue cost and effort, how it all fits together. And also, I think people were trying to do the right thing, but in so doing, they've sort of overread what we meant, that because we were very specific about the modifications for the modified retrospective approach, that meant that you had to do it absolutely perfectly, and we had a higher hurdle than for normal retrospective application. And I think it would be helpful to clarify that. But over and above not amending things, I wonder whether we need to perhaps think about doing something from an education perspective to help people, because rereading that modified retrospective transition stuff in preparation for this meeting, it is not very easy to read.
Takes a while.
It might be beautiful, you know, perfectly drafted, but I think it's hard.
Yeah.
We were thinking that something along walking through the diagram in the appendix to the piece, the whole educational material we could think about putting out. Time permitting.
All right.
Vote on all of them at once. We have a couple, so maybe all at the same time.
Does anyone object to voting on all the recommendations in the paper at the same time?
No.
Okay, and then that's us. So they're summarised in paragraph 4 then.
Yeah, pretty much. Fourteen.
That's it, no?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
See you next month.
Now we made a plan.